Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today, the Bolivian coup and the creation of a Latin American police state. My guests, the first will be Professor William Robinson. He is professor of sociology and Latin American studies at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He's also on the university's faculty in its Global and International Studies program. He's a scholar activist, deeply involved in third world struggles for social justice, the Latin American left, popular empowerment of populations, and participatory democracy and government. His areas of focus include globalization, transnationalism, political economies, immigration, and a variety of sociological issues. He received his graduate degrees from the University of Mexico. In the 1980s, he worked as a journalist and activist during the revolution in Nicaragua. He's published 9 books, his latest being Into the Tempest, Essays on the New Global Capitalism, which investigates how global capitalism is now controlled by a multinational capitalist class and is contributing to draconian policies in the U.S. and other developed nations, giving rise to the nationalist police states. His forthcoming book, scheduled for release next year, is The Global Police State. His website is soc.ucsb.edu/faculty/Robinson. He will be for the first part of our program. The second person will be Professor Jeb Sprague. Now, he is a research associate at the University of California at Riverside, specializing in globalization trends, transnationalism, political sociology, and the effects of all this on the Caribbean and Latin American economies. He is the co-founder of the Network for Critical Studies of Global Capitalism, and he's previously taught at the University of Virginia and at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And he is also the author of Globalizing the Caribbean, and earlier, Paramilitarism and the Assault on Democracy in Haiti. Nice to have you with us today, Professor William Robinson.
Pleasure to be back on.
With all the media attention on the impeachment hearings, other events around the world are being ignored, notably the U.S.-supported coup that has taken place in Bolivia and the ousting of its newly re-elected president, Evo Morales. This was even after Morales agreed to hold elections again after the Organization of American States found election tampering. Oddly, the vote count was halted after electricity, the internet, and phone systems of election headquarters mysteriously went out. The current interim government is extremely far-right, fascistic, and has an agenda against the indigenous population. In fact, the head of their new Senate, the president of the Senate, who was not elected, nor even selected, but simply said that she was now the president. Well, the United States and, unfortunately, Canada and other countries like Brazil have gone along with this and have recognized the new government, even though that this government was, the original government was taken out by a coup. Not only are they right wing, but we're witnessing in larger Latin America with totalitarian governments taking power and the American media siding more often than not with those who have orchestrated the coup, very much like Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton supported the coup in Honduras that they helped with the CIA to orchestrate. The American media has done this repeatedly. They did it with regime change in Libya, in Syria, and there seems to be no recourse for them taking on the world as in this hegemonic way. I'm concerned about it. I know you are as well. The new interim government is led by a fanatical right-wing religious ideologue, and wasted no time to immediately align with those who are representing the wealthy elite. And so this is the hard line. They're extremely racist. They're against all the indigenous populations, of which there are many. And Trump and American politicians, both left and right, are now labeling Morales as a dictator, similar to what was done towards Venezuela's Maduro after he won elections. And the right-wing governments, of, for example, that of Bolsonaro in Brazil and the other U.S. puppet leaders in Venezuela, have vocally supported the coup. So has the European Union. That should surprise no one, an utterly corrupt organization. So please begin by providing your analysis of the coup, and how do you explain the U.S.'s full support for it despite the accomplished Ms. Morales's made in the country, which have not been mentioned at all that I could find in any of the mainstream media, including on the left? Your thoughts, please. The forum is yours.
Sure. Well, this is without a doubt, because there's been some debate whether this is a coup or not a coup, and there's no doubt whatsoever that at this point this is a right-wing, a far-right-wing fascist, as you pointed out, fascist coup, which is backed by the military and the police. And absolutely, this is a time for progressives and leftists all around the world to close ranks in condemning this coup and in showing our solidarity with the struggle against this military and this fascist takeover. But having said that, and by the way, the repression is escalating in the last 48 to 72 hours. There's new massacres and everywhere. I mean, the country is descending into a nightmare. But having said that, I want to put this into a larger context. And the context here is the rise of the left in Latin America in the early 2000s. That included, of course, the Venezuelan Revolution, which is still ongoing, that has not been defeated, although it's in serious crisis. It included the election of Evo Morales in 2005, and then he took office in 2006, Rafael Correa, and the turn to the left in Ecuador. Of course, the Workers' Party, which assumed power in elections in 2002 in Brazil, and elsewhere in the region, in Nicaragua and El Salvador, there was a turn to the left throughout the region. And this turn to the left has deeply concerned over the last 20 years the right, the traditional political and economic elite, and, of course, the United States. And there has never been a moment in the past 20 years where the U.S. and the political and economic elites in Latin America have stopped trying to recover the political power, direct political power, that they lost. That is, getting rid of these leftist governments in power and having the old oligarchic far-right forces resume state power in these countries. But there's a larger story here. So that's how we have to see this context of Bolivia. The U.S. did not have the ability previously to overthrow Evo Morales. It attempted to do so in 2006, 2007. 2006 to 2009 was a period of tremendous conflict in Bolivia because the right and the far right, the traditional right of the United States, did everything possible to have an early uprising against Evo Morales. That was defeated. And so the U.S. really didn't have a choice but to accommodate itself to the government of the Morales government. But the same thing holds for most of these elected leftist governments in Latin America. We refer to that as the pink tide, the turn to the left over the last 20 years. But the right never lost its wishes and its intent to recover direct political power. It has done so in Brazil with the overthrow. Basically, it was a coup d'etat without the military involvement of Dilma Rousseff in 2013, followed by the rise to power now of the fascist Bolsonaro. That's in Brazil. In Ecuador, there was a change of government through elections, and the new government came under immense pressure from the U.S., from the International Monetary Fund, from the local elite, and turned the country sharply to the right. Venezuela is still facing a total counter-revolutionary siege, and so forth. So what's taking place in Bolivia is the latest iteration, and it's perhaps the most tragic because the repression right now is so serious. There hasn't been a military takeover, for instance, in Brazil or in Ecuador. But having said all of that, I also want to point out that the left in power committed mistakes that undermined a portion of its mass social base of support. The left, this is the elected party left, the institutional left that took over the reins of the state in Bolivia, in Ecuador, in Venezuela, in El Salvador, in Nicaragua, in Brazil, and so forth. And so, while, as I pointed out, this is the hour to close ranks in condemning this coup and in lining up with our total solidarity behind those resisting it. But also, we do need to be clear that the story is a little more complex simply than a coup against perfect leftist governments. What the model in Bolivia, and this is very important, for us to debate and to analyze. The model in Bolivia, as well as in the other Latin American countries where there have been turns to the left, has been what we call extractivism. And this extractivism, that is, that intensifying agribusiness, particularly the export of soy and palm oil on plantations, and also mineral exploitation, and oil and natural gas exploitation. The model has been to expand this type of extractivist industries and agriculture, and it has done so in Bolivia, but in alliance with the agribusiness elite in the eastern part of the country of Bolivia, the Santa Cruz elite, the same elite where Fernando Camacho and this fascist comes from. And so the economic model did not fundamentally threaten in the long run transnational corporate interests or local economic elite interests. In Bolivia, the same thing, not just I mentioned the agribusiness elite on the Santa Cruz eastern side, Amazonian side of the country, but also gave vast concessions to natural gas and vast concessions, for instance, for lithium that was just about to go into effect, lithium production. And so the economic model meant you tax these activities and we use that to expand social programs. And without a doubt, an unbelievable success, the use of these resources to expand social programs, to lift a major portion of the population out of poverty in Bolivia. And of course, we have to acknowledge that there has been a cultural, sociocultural revolution in Bolivia. So the indigenous have awakened, the indigenous pride and the fight against 500 years of racism is absolutely central. But we cannot lose sight also of this critique of the model followed by the left in power opened up some space for the right in these countries and the United States to push forward their struggle to recover direct political power and to undermine even the limited social programs that have been in place. So this is definitely a larger discussion. But I'll just conclude by saying that once again, this is the time, of course, to close ranks against this fascist coup.
Thank you. I appreciate that opening statement. When Evo Morales came to office, Bolivia was Latin America's poorest country. He lost four of six brothers to malnutrition. Yet his reforms turned Bolivia into the fastest growing nation, and over half its extreme poverty was gone. There's no other country in the world that can say that they did that in such a short period of time. Our media is completely silent about this, including on the left. And aside from the news about Bolivia's lithium reserves that you just mentioned, it also possesses the continent's second largest natural gas reserves. And besides these resources, there are others that the Western global capitalist class have their sights on in Bolivia. Now, behind all this is what you're familiar with, Occam's razor, the philosophical concept. That use the razor to cut away the nonsense and go right to the point. My point is this. How can we reasonably expect the right to do anything, since it's known for decades to be supporting every fascist element around the world and is purely tied in to the hegemonic powers of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund? But now we have the left that historically had been the anti-war group that was for civil rights, human rights, and was supporting labor unions and farmers' movements. And yet, just look carefully at the leading spokesperson for the left over the last 30 years, Hillary Clinton, more so than her husband. She was always the brains, and he was the charisma. And look what they did in Bosnia. Look what they did in could have stopped, but chose not to stop, in Rwanda. Look what they did in Northern Africa. Also, the 500,000 children died in Iraq. And then she specifically was proud of killing and having Gaddafi died and laughed about it on national television. We came, we saw he died, and then she cackled. Look at what she did with the overthrow with Nuland, and whose husband's the most powerful neocon in Washington, D.C., in the Ukraine. Look also at the deals the Clinton Foundation made for pay-to-play with getting 20% of Russia's uranium. Now look at what she did in Honduras. Look at the invasion of Libya and Syria. All of that is because of the power base that owns the Clintons. People think the Clintons are where it begins. It does not. They're simply very, very well, rewarded spokespersons for the group behind the scenes. So how in the world, when she was supporting Saudi Arabia, and they no one, not the New York Times, not the Washington Post, not CNN, nobody sent anyone for the first 2 years into the poorest country in the Middle East, no one cared about what was going on with the Yemenis, with tens of thousands of children dying. So then going right to the point, if the left is supported by the Democrat corporatists, and they've gone way right, and there's no other moderate voice willing to stand up and call these people out for what they're doing with regime changes and supporting dictatorships, then why should we believe that anything whatsoever is capable of being doing by the Washington consensus?
Right. Well, I will ditto and agree with everything you said except the very first line when you described Hillary Clinton as the left. Not in the least. I think the entire political, official, you know, mainstream political spectrum in the United States starts with the center-right and moves to the far-right. Trump and beyond Trump, a fascist far-right, and the Clinton dynasty, center-right. The Hillary Clinton and that whole crowd are very astute agents of imperialism and of transnational corporate domination around the world. So, I mean, I wouldn't characterize it as left. But, I mean, I agree with everything you are saying, and it's that larger picture in which we need to understand Bolivia. And, you know, I point out also, by the way, that there's all of, what is this, I think 19 now Democratic presidential hopefuls. There's really only one that's come out breaking away from the rest, and that's Bernie Sanders. He's condemned the coup in Bolivia. Elizabeth Warren did, too. But he's also condemned the aggression against Venezuela. Yesterday, Elizabeth Warren said that if she were president, she would continue sanctions against Venezuela and that she would recognize Juan Guaido, this total puppet from Venezuela. I'm sure your listeners know who I'm referring to. So really, it'd be the entire political, mainstream political spectrum in both parties in the United States is behind this global capitalist order. Except for, I'd make the exception of Bernie Sanders. But I want to also go back to something else you said, Gary. You pointed out these unbelievable social achievements in Bolivia, and that is absolutely right. The only country that did it just as fast as Bolivia, I would say, is Venezuela in the early years of its revolution. But let me also reiterate that the, as I refer to it, the transnational capitalist class has always wanted in Latin America, as they do in the Middle East and elsewhere, two things. They want direct control over resources around the world so they can exploit labor and exploit these natural resources. Evo Morales in Bolivia said, sure, you can exploit them, but not directly. And you're going to have to pay very high taxes, which we'll use for social programs. But that doesn't satisfy the transnational capitalist class. Secondly, the transnational capitalist class, which I characterize as a global ruling class, wants its direct political agents to be in control of governments, of the state. And Evo Morales was not its direct agent at all. So what you summarized worldwide, and with you know emphasis on Libya and the Middle East and so forth, is simply what we're seeing in Latin America is the Latin America equivalent of what we've seen elsewhere. But I want to say one other thing as well, and that is worldwide, the system is in crisis. It doesn't look like it's in crisis when they're overthrowing leftist governments like Evo Morales. Absolutely. But nonetheless, the system, and I've been on your program previously, and I've commented on this, the system faces a deep structural crisis. It also faces a crisis of legitimacy. People don't see it as legitimate anymore. And it's in that context where we're seeing a resurgence both of popular resistance from below all over the world. Lebanon, of course, throughout Latin America, Chile, Ecuador just a few weeks ago, Iraq, Iran, and so forth. We're seeing this resurgence of popular resistance from below, but we're also seeing a resurgence of the far fascist right. And that's exactly what's taking place in Bolivia at this point. The coup has sparked massive resistance from below. Even people that were not supporting Evo any longer are now fighting against this fascist takeover. But we're also seeing this fascist takeover. So you're seeing this polarization, and it's an absolutely critical moment politically worldwide.
Western economic neoliberalism in Latin America was born in Chile during the Pinochet regime, and when Milton Friedman's Chicago, philosophy which I'm totally opposed to. It was an experiment, but it was launched there during the Nixon years. Today, the country has one of the largest inequality gaps in Latin America, despite it being the continent's richest nation. Not much unlike the United States, last month, over a million Chileans rose up in nonviolent street protests against Sebastián Piñera's right-wing government, who happens to be a billionaire and one of the richest people in Chile, largely from introducing credit cards into the country. Can you speak, please, about this pattern that seems endemic in Latin America, whereby right-wing neoliberal governments aligned with Washington end up increasing the inequality rates, and also speak about the ongoing tension and adversity that exists between these elite neoliberal governments that are usually governed by corporate interests protecting the wealth and the social and economic stability of the oligarchs, and how that impacts the larger population.
Absolutely. Well, it's you're absolutely right to point to Chile. Chile was the dictatorship that overthrew the democratically elected government El Salvador Allende in 1973, the Pinochet dictatorship, of course, with the full backing and support of Washington and the Latin American right, and really the worldwide right, was where neoliberalism began. That was the launching of this global neoliberal project. And Chile was the case study. It was held up as the model of the success story of neoliberalism. And, you know, the slogan now in the streets in Chile is, neoliberalism was born in Chile, it will die in Chile, because that's what's being challenged in Chile. But after this model consolidated in Chile, it was spread all around the world, and what it involves is precisely, you've touched on a significant portion of it. Neoliberalism involves removing any constraints whatsoever to the complete control of resources and of labor and of public budgets and so forth by capitalists and by their political representatives. It basically frees up capital to do whatever it wants, to grab hold of all resources, to privatize everything, and to dismantle social welfare states. And this neoliberal juggernaut spread around the world in the 1980s and 1990s. After Chile, the front line of global neoliberalism was Latin America. The entire region turned neoliberal in the latter decades of the 20th century, and that resulted in precisely what you pointed out, a dramatic deterioration of the living conditions of the vast majority of the working and the poor people. The richer getting rich, complete social polarization, the dismantling of what little social programs existed throughout Latin America. And this provoked enormous struggles in the 1980s and 1990s and at the turn of the century. And so at the beginning of this the interview on your program, I was pointing out that the early 21st century was a turn to the left. Well, that turn to the left was in response to this neoliberal nightmare that descended upon the region. And that neoliberal nightmare never left Chile. It was challenged in many of the other countries of Latin America through the turn to the left. But Chile remains a neoliberal nightmare for the vast majority of Chileans and Chilenos. But what is happening now is, and again, this goes back to what I pointed out, there's a polarization taking place politically worldwide between a resurgent popular resistance, which is now challenging neoliberalism in Chile and elsewhere, and also a neo-fascist political right. And behind the economic project of that neo-fascist political right, such as in Bolivia, is to restore and even deepen neoliberalism, not just restore the neoliberalism that was rolled back in the region in the early 21st century, but actually deepen it with a new round of privatizations, a new round of impoverishments of the poor majority and so forth. And for this reason, given this analysis I'm putting forth, it's no wonder that this Bolivian self-declared government of Áñez has declared that we're going to privatize once again. So part of neoliberalism is all resources, everything. The government itself is turned over to private capitalist interests. So it's no wonder that Agnes comes to power. She unleashes this brutal repression, she and the military and the police and the right wing, against the indigenous and the working majority in Bolivia. But at the same time, they announced they're going to dismantle the whole anti-neoliberal program of Evo Morales. So that is that's where we're at. And, of course, we have neoliberalism in the United States. And you mentioned Hillary Clinton. I mean, Hillary Clinton is a Democratic neoliberal you know, Trump is called a nationalist or protectionist, but his actual program is the same thing, neoliberalism. Turn everything over to transnational corporate plunder. Have the rich get richer and the poor get poorer.
I appreciate your insights here. In conclusion to this part of our interview, I would add to what you've just said that we see an enormous shift towards the extreme right in Latin America, besides Morales, who has one of the he was one of the last socialist holdouts on the continent. Ecuador's Moreno has shifted right in opposition to Carrera's socialist reforms. Brazil now has an extreme totalitarian leader in Bolsonaro. Then there is Chile, as you already discussed, and also Argentina, which elected a business mogul. Mm-hmm. All of these new administrations are aligned with the U.S. capitalist globalist efforts. In the broader picture, we're seeing a dramatic shift away from any socialist reforms towards the right and the elite class across Latin America, and the American media is fully captured. The only good thing, and I say the only good thing, about Trump's election was that it showed for the first time the full extent of the power of the deep state and its players coming out to challenge him. Had Hillary been elected, nothing would have been in the news about any of these corruptions. I want to thank you very much, William Robinson, for being on. And we're going to take a break and come back with our next guest. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, Gary. Thank you.
Professor William Robinson. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us.
Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. I'd like to welcome you to a special presentation of the Progressive Commentary Hour. In this segment, we're going to be listening to Dr. Jeb Sprague. He is a research associate at the University of California at Riverside. He specializes in globalization trends and transnationalism and political sociology and their effects on the Caribbean and Latin America. He is the co-founder of the Network for the Critical Studies of Global Capitalism and has previously taught at the University of Virginia and the University of California at Santa Barbara, the latter academic institution being where he received his doctorate in sociology. He is the author of Globalizing the Caribbean and earlier, Paramilitarism and the Assault on Democracy in Haiti. His articles have appeared in many academic journals as well as the Gray Zone, The Canary, and Counterpunch. His website is Jeb Sprague, I'll spell it, Sprague, blogspot.com. And we're continuing with our discussion on U.S. paramilitary interference in the Bolivian coup, as well as in Haiti. Nice to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Gary. If I can just correct you on my website, it's Jeb Sprague, so it's jebsprague.blogspot.com.
Thank you. During the first half of the program, Professor William Robinson, who I understand was one of your academic mentors, was on to speak about the U.S.-supported coup in Bolivia in the context of the radical swing to the right-wing extremist governments in Latin America. One area, the Bolivian coup, you have investigated was the role of American paramilitary interest and influences in Bolivia, notably the relationship between some of the top coup leaders and the U.S. Defense Department's Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, formerly known as the U.S. Army School of Americas at Fort Benning in Georgia, as well as with the FBI. I just note to listeners that the school was founded in the 1940s as part of training Latin American military intelligence personnel in anti-communist counterinsurgency tactics. In 2001, under the Bush administration's National Defense Authorization Act, it was renamed to its present title. So please take your time and speak about the role the U.S. had through its paramilitary channels that the media did not cover at all to interfere in Bolivian elections and help orchestrate the coup. And what is the association the coup leaders and leaders of the parties opposed to the Morales government with the School of the Americas? And in your estimation, what else can you share about the coup leaders' larger political and economic agenda for the nation, and how does it align with U.S. foreign policy in Latin America? Ultimately, it is the capitalist agenda behind many of these right-wing coups and overthrows taking place. So what is the global capitalist agenda or the hegemony project for Bolivia? The forum is yours.
Thanks so much, Gary. So first off, I would say that we have seen coup d'etats, intervention by the U.S. in a lot of countries in Latin America. A lot of your listeners will be familiar with the long history going back to the Monroe Doctrine, how Trump's former national security advisor even talked about how the Monroe Doctrine is still in effect, that the U.S. has the overriding responsibility, he would say, to intervene and operate in the Western Hemisphere, and that it is our backyard. But what we see with what happened on November 10th, this coup d'etat that occurred in Bolivia, it was covered one way in the media and here in the United States and in the Western media, but it really played out in a very different way than it's been covered in the mainstream media. And so I want to thank you for dedicating the whole show into this and really letting us dig into it. Like I told you before the show, I've been contacted by a lot of international media from Turkey, France, in Asia, Russia, and Canada, but I have very few U.S. media outlets contact me. So thank you for doing this show. The way that it's been covered in the media is that it was a transition, that Morales resigned, that he was growing increasingly authoritarian, and that the people were rebelling. One thing that has not been talked about, though, is that in the day, the lead up and after the coup, there were about 5,000. This has been, people are putting out studies, reports on this now. There were about 5,000 Twitter accounts made on social media that were made right that around that time period in November. And if you looked at them, they would all have one or two followers. And they started this massive campaign on social media to smear anyone calling it a coup, to attack Morales, to really make it appear as if this was a legitimate transfer of power and that he needed to go. But when we pull behind the curtain and we really look at what happened, there's a couple different factors here in regards to soft power, U.S. funding through USAID for a lot of opposition groups within the country, a lot of issues like that. And, you know, there's an opposition within the country. There are people that have legitimate critiques of his government. There's also a right wing in the country, part of the population who are positively racialized, and some of them have engaged, of course, in a very racist campaign against Morales and his supporters that are really rooted in the marginalized, negatively racialized part of the population. And so what we see, that the article that I published on the Gray Zone was another key factor that has been completely ignored in the media, but the role of the United States in really cultivating through the School of the Americas, through its the military and police command structure in Bolivia. And so my piece looks at that in detail. And so I discuss how, for example, I did this through a variety of different open source research techniques. I'm an academic, but from time to time, I like to write things in popular media just because I like for my material to be read. And so I did this quick open source research. I spent a few days on it. And I found there's audio leaks that were all over Bolivian media, that if you talk to Bolivian journalists, that these are seen as completely legitimate, accurate, that these are it's a recorded conversation, an audio leak of people plotting the coup in the days leading up to the coup. And it's former military men that have a lot of contacts throughout the Bolivian security forces. And through listening to the audio, I was able, with a colleague, to listen to it, go over the conversation, and identify four individuals and their names who had introduced themselves or were referring to other people on the call. And we matched their names up with the alumni list of the School of the Americas. There's an organization called School of the Americas Watch, a human rights and anti-war organization run by priests and reverends and nuns, mostly an anti-war activists who have experience in Latin America, you know, that they know about the massacres and coup d'etats that so many graduates of the School of the Americas were involved with. And so they have gathered this list through Freedom of Information Act documents and other ways where they have a list of the individuals that were involved. And so I could pin down that four of the individuals on the phone call were School of the Americas graduates. And then there was another guy, a former mayor of Cochabamba and a former presidential candidate, a well-known right-wing figure who now lives in the United States. His name's Manfred Reyes Villa. And he was also, they talk about him, he's a key figure in the plot, and he was also a School of the Americas graduate. Then what I did was I went and looked at the head of the police and the head of the military, a guy named Williams Caliman, who is the head of the country's military, who on November 10th suggested that Morales step down. You know, when you have the head, it'd be like that the head of the Pentagon suggested Trump steps down. I mean, this is, and the police the day before had rebelled, or sections of the police had rebelled under another guy named Calderon, Vladimir Yuri Calderon Mariscal. And he is the head of the police force in the country. And so I found that both of these individuals, when we looked at their background, the head of the police, who was really the key figure, the first security figure to really buckle and support this overthrow, in 2018, he had worked as a police attaché of the Bolivian embassy in Washington, D.C., and headed up a group named APALA, which is a grouping of police chiefs and high police figures from different Latin American countries. That get together in Washington, D.C., and they gather there, and they work closely with FBI, ICE, DEA. And so I talk about how they work in the country. I was there, their website and their phone number, their website's down, their phone number doesn't work. I was unable to get in contact with them, but there's a website called the Wayback Machine, where it takes photos of old websites, and so you can see the, you know, earlier versions of all these different, of so many websites on the internet, of most of the internet, in fact. And so I was able to look at photos of the old images of the old versions of the website, this Apple website, and I found a lot of information and photos of this guy, Calderon Mariscal. He was at the FBI, their main academy, 36 miles out of Washington, D.C. And then the other guy, Williams Caliman, the head of the military, he had been an attaché in the Bolivian military at the Bolivian D.C. in Washington in 2013, but he had also taken a class at the School of the Americas in 2003. So then what I did was I turned to this book by Philip Agee called Inside the Company that was published in 1975. Some of your listeners have probably heard of this book. Philip Agee, he's deceased now. I had the chance to meet him actually at the World Social Forum in 2005. But he was the first major whistleblower of the CIA. And this tell-all book, which is a fascinating book, he explains in part of it how traditionally the CIA would often try to recruit or gather information, create friendships amongst top-tier security officials, military officials, and also attachés. And so the CIA can't just like walk up to somebody and recruit them or gather information. He talks about how they often work through other agencies like USAID, the FBI, and through that they're able to create sources and long-term relationships and even recruit people. I mean, I can't speculate too much, but my belief is that there's something much deeper behind this coup, and that Bolivia was a soft target because the Nicaraguan, Venezuelan, and Cuban militaries are, you know, are independent and are not integrated with U.S. military training programs and things where intelligence people can burrow into them. Whereas the Bolivian military, even though Evo Morales, you know, was conducting different policies, you know, that didn't go alongside of the U.S., he still, he never kicked USAID out of the country, and there were still these police and military connections with Bolivia. You know, Bolivia is a very poor country, and, you know, a lot of pressures, institutional pressures, and things that Morales faced that he wouldn't have had the resources of a country like Venezuela.
Let's go a little further. It seems to me that the earlier attempt to oust Maduro in Venezuela shares a similar pattern with what we're witnessing in Bolivia, although the Venezuelan attempt has so far failed. Were the leaders of the Venezuela opposition parties, such as the one led by Guaido, also associated with the School of the Americas?
Well, that's just the problem that that they faced inside Venezuela, is that the military under Chavez, and since Chavez, they restructured their military in such a way where it was not headed up by people who, you know, are close with U.S. military and U.S. security agencies, or they're not doing, you know, joint training and these sorts of, they cut off a lot of the programs through which U.S. intelligence would be able to burrow into these different institutions. And so that February coup attempt in Venezuela, I think Trump was really misled by some of his major war hawks in his cabinet that thought that they could successfully carry out a coup, right? And they were almost overeager. And that completely fell apart. And actually some of the people, including a top official within SEBIN, Venezuela's intelligence agency, were basically exposed through that failed coup as working covertly with the United States and with Colombia. And so that coup was very much a disaster. But it's also, that coup was part of a bigger destabilization campaign, right? Venezuela has been targeted by the United States going back to 2000. That coup attempt in 2002 and through different phases. But this destabilization effort has really amplified since the new year, even the year before that under Trump. But now we see this hybrid war and an economic war that one of the most brutal hybrid wars in recent memory, right? They've cut the country off, blocked a lot of its markets and energy. They've even blocked sometimes imports from getting into the country, suing so many different business people, stopping third parties from working with them, cutting off Visa, MasterCard. They've even got different like Photoshop and computer software and things that make it where they can't function. The licenses won't work in Venezuela. There's a good amount of evidence suggesting that the earlier in the year when they had a lot of electric grids that were going down in Venezuela, there's good evidence to suggest that that was part of a cybernetic attack that the United States launched. So really this dirty hybrid war, Venezuela and Bolivia, there's a lot of particularities within those societies
different tensions, problems. There are, of course, legitimate criticisms of those governments, the different compromises they've made, or people inside of them, and all of these things. But I argue, and also I published an article with a cannery about this, called Washington's Hybrid War on Venezuela. But I argue really that this hybrid war is the central factor that's blocking the country from getting off its knees and trying to repair itself. And Washington has also advised and financed political opposition in the country. The opposition will not negotiate or compromise. So in 2018, when they had the elections in Venezuela, when Maduro was running against the opposition had a good chance to win that election, but the U.S. basically convinced their proxies, the groups that they finance and are real close with, to not run in that election, and they pressured Henry Falcón, the main opposition candidate. They even threatened him with, like, you know, financial blocking his accounts, his foreign accounts and things, not to run. And so a lot of people ended up boycotting, and Falcón lost that election in mid-2018. And there were actually, you know, the OAS refused to send monitors, Western monitors were not there, except for there were CARICOM and the African Union. They had monitors on their ground. And Zapatero, the former prime minister of Spain, was there. And so we really see this concerted effort to bring down Venezuela. And because that failed, the U.S. has altered their strategy to go after other countries, other governments and movements in the region that are aligned with that ALBA project, that alternative endogenous attempted development in the region, right, breaking with U.S. diktat and U.S.
Jeb,
IMF policy.
Jeb, we only have time for one last question, and it's about Haiti. By the way, as an aside, the woman who was not elected, she just appointed herself president of the Senate there, has a strong animus against indigenous culture and says that it's purely superstition and they're not going to have any role in the government and they're not going to be cared for. In effect, they're starting a new campaign that could end up with the lives lost of many indigenous people, and the American media has been indifferent to this. But I want to switch to Haiti, which has had a long history of U.S.-supported paramilitary operations, and it continues today in a nation you specialize in. The dire situation in Haiti now is also being completely ignored by our mainstream media. About 60% of Haitians do not have enough food to survive, and it's the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere. The U.S. has meddled in Haitian affairs for at least 60 years. People do not realize that for years, Venezuela has been helping Haitians by supplying greatly reduced-priced oil. But that has diminished due to American sanctions, and President Mosi's administration is ultimately corrupt and has likely stolen billions from the Haitian people. And we hear much more about the riots happening in Hong Kong, but during the past year, there have been a rise in pro-democracy protests that have led to bloodshed as well. You wouldn't know that by reading the American media. So two questions. One, what role have the Clintons and Obama played in the subjugation of Haiti and the exploitation of Haiti? And do you see that Haiti is capable of coming back to life? It's a completely failed state at this moment.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about that there. There's a lot to talk there about. And maybe I can just preface it with telling you I do have two books that are relevant to this. In 2012, my book, Paramilitarism and the Assault on Democracy, it really looks at the reproduction of paramilitarism in the country, the way that it's been used as a form of social control to really violently repress the poor majority in the country and the negatively racialized majority in the country. And so it goes all the way back, looking at the you know, the U.S. occupation.
Okay, but we're running short on time. Please address it now. We have about 7 minutes.
Okay. So, I mean, if we move up to the present period, which is what you want to really look at, paramilitary groups, they've had complete impunity after the 2004 coup. With the 2010 earthquake, you had the return of a Duvalierist, what I call a neo-Duvalierist political project in the country under the leadership of Michel Martelly, who heads up a political party called the bald-headed political party. That's how you would say it in English. And it's this very hard right party that works closely with the Republicans in the United States. And the guy that's come in after him, Jovenel Moïse, has continued that project and refounded the military that was disbanded in the late 90s under the government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, right? And Lavalas, who was overthrown in the 91 and 2004 coup d'etat. And so we really see a recreation of that right-wing project in the country. In regards to Clinton and Obama, I think in Haiti we really see it in its most crystallized form the bipartisan nature of U.S. empire. You know, Obama Michel Martelly came to office when Obama was in command, and the State Department, U.S. Embassy, they continued. You know, they side with the right and neoliberal groups in the third world, in the global south. You know, when Clinton was in office, when they allowed Aristide to return in 94 after 3 years of this narco dictatorship, you know, Bill Clinton worked to make sure that in order to return, that the Haitian government would have to accept all these austerity measures and the role of the IMF. Right. And then we know the role of his wife, Hillary Clinton, in the invasion of Libya and the coup in Honduras. So you really see the bipartisan nature of U.S. foreign policy in the region. And I think, you know, we see all this happening, as your previous speaker, Dr. Robinson, talked about, as global capitalism, you know, of this whirlpool of transnational capitalist accumulation across the region. It's happening with this like ruthless competition of all of these companies, really looking for cheap labor, and but also, you know, there's a strata of consumer people making money across the region, and there's also a lot of marginalized people that migrate and have no jobs. And so the United States, if you look at think tank papers in D.C., the two of the big things they talk about in regards to the Caribbean is, one, repressing the marginalized, like people in Haiti. How do you deal with these people, all these unemployed people that protest and don't accept U.S., you know, people that we like in those countries? And then, two, the other thing they write about is Cuba and Venezuela and the countries that have this organized resistance to U.S. hegemony across the region. So we see global capitalism and the changes with the transnational economy, but at the same time, our country, the U.S. is still an empire, and we still are active across the world in promoting the interests of transnational capital and working with our different allies in the region.
But you wouldn't know that from the mainstream media, because Obama and the Clintons have been given a pass on any investigative reporting. I've seen no quality investigative reporting by 60 Minutes, by 2020, by Dateline, on what they did, especially after the hurricane, of collecting upwards of $12 billion, along with George Bush, junior and senior, and yet the money did not end up in Haiti. It ended up back in American government's hands, foreign government's hands, individuals' hands, especially those individuals who've donated to the Clinton Foundation. That is an off-limit topic. The media will not touch it, and has lost all credibility. But I'm glad that you are touching on these and going into depth on those books, and thank you very much. We're out of time, but I want people to know that it's JebSprague.blogspot.com, correct?
Yeah, it's JebSprague.blogspot.com, and My newest book is called Globalizing the Caribbean. So thanks so much, Gary, for having this topic for your show today.
Happy to have had you on, both of you, and Jeb. So we'll look forward to another conversation, and also to Professor William Robinson. Thank you very much. I'm Gary Noll. This has been the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me.